This is Talk of the Nation. I'm John Idstey in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. The political world has an amazing power to reduce complicated ideological and moral positions into quick and easy catchphrases. Remember tree huggers, soccer moms, and compassionate conservatives? One of the most popular right now is culture of life. Three simple words which appear more and more frequently in the mouths of politicians and on the editorial pages of newspapers. The issue of the moment is Terri Schiavo, but the culture of life is also invoked in debates as far apart as stem cell research and the death penalty. As the range of these issues suggests, the meaning behind the phrase is hardly simple. Today we step back to look at the origins of this political phenomenon in the Catholic Church and its adoption by conservative evangelical Protestants. The calls for government intervention in the Terri Schiavo case test the boundaries of this culture of life coalition. Some conservatives are struggling to reconcile their devotion to life with their opposition to government intervention. Today, we want to hear from Christian conservatives. Do you support a culture of life? Are those beliefs compatible with other conservative positions? And if they come into conflict, which do you follow? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Later, how aid organizations are retooling their tsunami response to deal with yesterday's Indonesian earthquake, and today's highly critical new report on the UN's Oil for Food program. But first, the culture of life. Our first guest is John Green, professor of religion and politics at the University of Akron. He joins us by phone from Syracuse University in New York State, where he is attending a conference. Welcome, Professor Green.
It's good to be with you.
Briefly, what is the culture of life?
Well, it's a phrase, as your introduction indicated, that really came out of Catholic social thought. As best I can tell, the phrase was first used in an official capacity by Pope John Paul II back in 1983 in a speech that he gave. And since then, the Pope and other Catholic leaders have frequently used the phrase. And in the Catholic context, I think it might be defined the following way. The culture of life would be a universal commitment to protect and nature all of life from conception until natural death.
And in the Catholic Church, is it widely accepted, would you say?
I think it really is fairly widely accepted among Catholic theologians and clergy. It may be not as accepted as widely among the Catholic laity, but, you know, that's very common in churches. Not everybody who belongs to a particular denomination necessarily holds all of the beliefs.
And what issues fall under this notion of a culture of life?
Well, it actually covers a lot of different things, and it reflects a very consistent application of Catholic theology to a variety of different issues. Certainly, abortion is part of it, the debate over stem cells, the whole question of abstinence-based sex education. But it also includes, to Catholics, the death penalty, views towards the legitimacy of war, and it can be extended in a couple of different directions. For instance, the Catholic position opposes artificial contraception, and that's seen as a culture of life issue, but also nurturing children and redistributing wealth to help poor people could be seen as part of this broader culture of life.
Mm-hmm. And you would agree that the phrase, at least, was adopted by the Catholic Church and then picked up by Protestant conservatives?
Oh, yes, it was. It was picked up by a variety of evangelical theologians, and perhaps more importantly, for the present usage, by Protestant politicians, most notably George W. Bush, who frequently uses the term the culture of life. Coming from President Bush, I think it has a somewhat more nebulous meaning and tends to focus a bit more on issues such as abortion and marriage, rather than all of the broader bundle of issues that Catholics would include.
So you would say that Catholics and conservative Protestants aren't necessarily using this term in the same way, that Protestants might leave out some of the things that Catholics would include and vice versa?
They might very well, yes. And perhaps the best example of that is the view of these different religious communities on the death penalty. Many evangelical and other Protestants think that the death penalty is a perfectly acceptable thing if it's carried out in the right way and and the rights of the accused are protected. Whereas many Catholics are much more skeptical of the death penalty and believe that in many, if not all, cases, the death penalty is immoral.
Hello, Professor, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Let me ask you this. For Catholics, though, are you... abortion has always seemed to be at the top of the list in sort of concerns of the culture of life. Do you think it has equal weight, really, among Catholic lay people with the importance of, you know, preserving the life of criminals even after they committed a crime?
Well, you know, there is some debate among Catholic theologians as to exactly what weight these different issues should be given in the culture of life. For instance, most Catholic theologians would see abortion as a very bad thing, but there might be prudential judgments that would lead one, say, to support a military action in a particular instance, or there might be extreme cases where the execution of a criminal might be the best that a society can do to protect other lives. But, you know, among the Catholic laity, I think there's a great deal of diversity. Many Roman Catholics are pro-choice. Many of them use artificial contraception, and many of them support the death penalty. So I think if you get out into the broader Catholic community, there's much more disagreement on these issues than among theologians.
It's exactly what I was going to ask you. What did the polls say about sort of how mainstream these positions are, both among people of the church, both Catholic and Protestant churchgoers, and the broader public?
Well, there's oftentimes a disagreement on this. Americans are very deeply divided on abortion. There tends to be something of a pro-choice majority, depending on how you ask the question, but there's a good number of pro-life people as well. But on stem cells, a majority of Americans, including a majority of Catholics, think that the government ought to allow research into stem cells. And on the death penalty, there tends to be a majority of Americans that favor it under the appropriate circumstances. So we don't really, even within the Catholic community, have the kind of seamless garment of life or consistent ethic of life that many Catholic theologians have advocated.
Mm-hmm. Let's bring in Alan Lichtman now. Joining us is Alan Lichtman, a professor of political history at American University and the author of the upcoming book, The History of the 20th Century American Conservative Politics. He joins us here in Studio 3A. Professor Lichtman, is the definition of conservative changing, and to what extent are conservatives conflicted now about this whole notion of the culture of life?
As I look across the 20th century, I see conservatives changing their positions on particular issues. At one point, for example, conservatives were isolationist. At another point, firmly interventionist when it came to foreign policy. However, I see great continuity in two core values of conservatism throughout the 20th century. Number one, conserving private enterprise. And we see that today with conservatives taking the lead on rewriting the bankruptcy laws or restricting the power of juries in liability cases. The other core value that I see is preserving what conservatives see as traditional Christian morality. At one time early in the 20th century, that meant the prohibition of alcohol. Today, as we've heard, it primarily involves the anti-abortion movement, although that's certainly not all there is to it. Now, like all ideologies, there are conflicts between these two core values and conflicts within them. That's why the Schiavo case is so important, because unlike any episode in recent memory, it has brought to the fore those contradictions. On the one hand, conservatives traditionally have tended to stress states' rights, local decision-making. Yet here they want the federal government to override 7 years of state litigation on a matter traditionally reserved to the states. Secondly, conservatives have stressed the sanctity of the marital bond in private decision-making. And here again, they want the state to step in and override that. Conservatives have stressed strict construction of the Constitution, not reading in one's values. Yet here they have implored the courts to find an absolute right to life that isn't in the Constitution. Perhaps nowhere, though, is the contradiction more clear than with Tom DeLay, who has been very much the public face of the conservative interventionist position. Today, Tom DeLay supports Terri Schiavo as a disabled person. Yet he was one of only 28 members of the House to vote against the Americans with Disabilities Act. Why? Because he thought it placed too great a burden on business. Again, the conflict of those core values.
Is it too simple to just say what you have in the Republican Party is basically a libertarian wing, that is, less government intervention, and a social conservative wing, and that in the Schiavo case you basically have them clashing? They can have much in common. Many of the people who are religious conservatives and social conservatives might believe in preserving life, but they also believe in keeping the government out of most of their business.
I think that's much too simple, in fact. There is a libertarian movement today, which historically, back in the 1960s, really separated itself out from mainstream conservatives. Most conservatives, if you look at voting in Congress, for example, both support private enterprise and support traditional Christian morality. There isn't much of a libertarian wing in the conservative movement that would say, for example, abolish the drug laws, have free choice on abortion. If you look at voting in Congress, voting at state legislatures, that isn't found. What you're really finding here, though, is a contradiction between a lot of the policies that conservatives would set forth for protecting business, like limited government, limited reading of the Constitution, and their strong support for a powerful interventionist big government when it comes to issues of morality. Those two philosophies have existed uneasily within the Republican Party and within conservatives, but a strict libertarian wing, absolutely not.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about the culture of life. Do you advocate some of the positions in this umbrella term, like a ban on abortion and physician-assisted suicide? Do you have problems with all of them being included together? We're taking your calls at 800-989-TALK. You can send us an email. The address is totn@npr.org. I'm John Itzty. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm John Itzty in Washington. We're talking about the religious and political dimensions of the culture of life. You're invited to join the discussion. We especially want to hear from conservative callers. Do you consider yourself a part of the culture of life? Does it influence your political activities? Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And with us in our studios are Alan Lichtman, professor of political history at American University, and Professor John Green, a professor of religion and politics at the University of Akron. Professor Green, I want to ask you, what do you think? Is this culture of life and this Schiavo case right now creating conflict within this coalition, this conservative coalition of the culture of life?
Oh, yes, I do. I would agree with Alan Lichtman completely on this. I think what we see exemplified in the Schiavo case are different conservative values, even different religious values, that are actually in conflict with each other in this particular instance. And, you know, conservatives oftentimes tend to settle their differences somewhat more quietly than liberals do, but I think there's some real tensions that this case has brought to that fore.
Mm-hmm. We've certainly seen that on the part of a number of congressmen, John Warner from Virginia talking about principles of federalism being a problem in terms of the intervention in the Schiavo case, and former Congressman Bob Barr of Georgia saying the same thing.
Yes, and that's the case. But we've also had some other members of Congress, Tom DeLay, which was mentioned a moment ago, and the Majority Leader, Bill Frist, sort of championing the cause with the bill they passed on Palm Sunday. It's not clear to me exactly how these things are going to be sorted out because different individuals will have different priorities as to which values should be given more salience.
Well, let's get our listeners into the discussion. Elizabeth in Cincinnati, you have a question?
Yes, I actually have a comment. I definitely identify myself as a conservative Christian, as well as a Republican, and I'm definitely in a minority as a 27-year-old female, especially coming from a state. I'm from Minnesota. I happen to be on the road in Cincinnati. And it's interesting because my particular opinion in this case definitely differs from those around me that consider themselves conservative Christians as well as happen to be Republicans. And it really frustrates me that government is getting involved with the sanctity of marriage. And I truly believe that in this particular case, it is up to the husband to decipher his wife's wishes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's ask Alan Lichtman for a quick comment.
Yeah, Elizabeth, I think that's right. And I think even leaving aside the issue of support for business and those contradictions, I think within the Christian conservative side, there is a fundamental contradiction. What seems to be driving the Shivo protests is the anti-abortion movement. People like Randall Terry, head of Operation Rescue.
And those are obviously two very, very different things.
Exactly.
And it frustrates me as that they would group these two. They would group this woman who I believe she was alive into her mid-20s, a fully functioning human being that lived a full life, that they would group her in the same category as an unborn child.
Precisely.
Well, life is precious, and I really don't... The whole abortion issue is completely separate from this, therefore I'm not going to comment, but it's two different cases, and it's unfair to the Shivos to really group that in the same category.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth.
I want to
bring in another guest. Wendy Wright is here in the studio with us. She is a senior policy advisor for Concerned Women for America, a national organization that seeks to integrate biblical principles into public policy. Wendy Wright, you've heard a lot said about the culture of life up to now. Would you agree with what you've heard?
No, and I feel we've been mischaracterized as well. We're driven by a great respect for human life, and we feel that both an individual and society's responsibility, a primary purpose, is to protect innocent life. Now, we find that in the cases of with abortion, where because someone's been described as being small, as looking different than us, that they're less capable or have less abilities than we do, or they reside in a different place inside the womb, that therefore they should not have the same rights, basic right to live, that everyone else. And now we see this seeping into the case with Terry Schiavo of euthanasia, of someone who's disabled. She's not as capable as us, so therefore she doesn't have the same right to live. Regarding marriage, it's because we hold marriage on such a high level that we feel that what Michael has done is violate his marriage vows. He has been, as we all know, living with another woman, has two children by her. He melted down Terry's wedding ring to create jewelry for himself. We often hear about how Terry rescued cats. Well, do you know what he did with her cats? After she fell into this terrible condition, he had them euthanized. He's refused to have her wheelchair fixed so that she can go outside. He's refused her speech and swallowing and rehabilitation therapy. So all this shows that he's made a mockery of his marriage.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this, though. Do you, as a conservative, also wish that the government were not involved in these kind of things? I mean, do you want the government involved in things like life and death decisions made by families?
Well, it's because life is so precious that we need to have protections. And in a case like this, where Michael has been so abusive toward Terry since she has fallen into this condition, that there needs to be opportunities for others to step in to speak for her, to speak on her behalf. Her family's tried to, and they've been shut down in the court system. And, you know, when Congress acted, all they were doing was saying, let's have someone else look at all the facts in the case. You know, there's only been one judge that's looked at all the facts of the case. The appellate courts only looked at the process. They didn't look at the facts. And so Congress is merely saying, let's get someone other than just Judge Greer have a chance to take a look at all the facts.
I want to ask you one other thing, and that is how broadly you see the culture of life. As we've heard from Professor Green,
yes,
the Catholic Church views this as a very broad spectrum, including opposition to capital punishment. Would you include that in your view of the culture of life?
Yes. Evangelicals tend to be a bit different when it comes to a definition of the culture of life, and it is a little more limited, and it would relate to the very innocent, the most vulnerable, that are having their very right to live taken away from them, and that would include then the unborn, the disabled, and we see that happening with embryo research as well, the killing of embryos just because they're considered small and they look different than us.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to another caller, Cameron in Grand Rapids, I presume that's Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Yeah, you're right. Hi.
Hi, Cameron. Do you have a question or a comment?
A comment. Let's see. I think the definition of life needs to be extended in a broader way. I'm a devoted Jesus follower. I'm trying to follow him the best I can. But I see, you know, intense hypocrisy in the American church, to be pro-life in some areas and not pro-life in others. And I would like to see pro-life be extended to include fetuses, of course, inmates, Iraqis, the environment, our planet. And I challenge, you know, the American church to look at what Jesus did in a time of intense control by the Romans. You know, he lived at peace with intense persecution. And, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wendy Wright, how would you respond to Mark?
Well, I know that there are a number of people in the evangelical movement who feel the same way it should be extended, and some are getting rather active. For ourselves at Concerned Women for America, we feel that human life is so vulnerable and is really at stake right now. We want to learn from history, not just learn what happened, but apply the lessons to today. And when we look at what happened in Nazi Germany, that the first that were euthanized were the handicapped and the disabled, and it was because of a standard that was given of they have a less of a quality of life. It's a life not worth living. And so when we see these same arguments happening today, yes, we need to do what we can to care for the animals, care for the environment. But when you consider that innocent human life is being killed in some of the most gruesome ways, then that really takes a priority for many of us.
Mm-hmm. Alan Lichtman, something that Wendy Wright said, and that was that what Congress did was not that big a deal. That is, they passed a law that asked that this go back into the federal courts. Would you, as a historian and a political observer, say that was not a big deal, or was it a big deal?
Several comments. One, what most of the conservatives wanted was actually to override the state courts. It was only a compromise position to have the federal courts take a second look. And yes, it was most unusual to have a matter which was traditionally left to the states, which was litigated for 7 years by the states, to suddenly have the government step in. A couple of other points I'd like to make, though. As a Professor Green pointed out, with respect to the culture of life and the Catholic position, it also embodies a very strong social justice tradition, as I think the caller Cameron alluded to. The Catholic tradition would be very concerned about 40 million people who are uninsured today and whose lives are in jeopardy because of it. They'd be very concerned about people in poverty whose lives are in jeopardy because of it. Groups like Concerned Women for America don't take up those kinds of issues. Finally, because no one is here, Michael Schiavo isn't here, I'm a little bit disturbed by those who say we support life and innocent life, to drag his name through the mud the way we saw on this show today and the way we've seen throughout. All of these charges were thoroughly litigated in the courts for 7 years. They were rejected. He is the legal guardian. The courts ruled that he correctly represent the wishes of his wife. All of these arguments, I think, are quite shameful.
Some conservatives are struggling to reconcile their devotion to life with their belief in a light-handed government, and the Terri Schiavo case stands out at the crux of the divide. We turn now to Douglas Kamek, a professor of constitutional law at Pepperdine University in Malibu, California. He was also the head of the Office of Legal Counsel for President Ronald Reagan and the first President Bush. He joins us from his office in Malibu. Welcome, Professor Kamek.
Good to be with you.
Has the Terri Schiavo case tested some of your political and personal beliefs?
Well, it has certainly caused me to examine how one reconciles law and morality. This is a perennial question, and it's not easily answered. But Terri Schiavo's case put both in stark relief. As I've previously said, I am quite skeptical of Congress's constitutional power to do what they did for a variety of well-settled principles dealing with the separation of powers and federalism and other reasons. But I also think that our country began its experiment in governance with a document, and it's a document that said life is inalienable. And to be inalienable means that no one can give it away, that it is of ultimate value. But we have great legal incoherence at the moment, because even though that's our founding document, We have a Supreme Court decision in 1990, the Cruzan case, which seemingly says that not only medical care can be disclaimed, but also food and water can be refused. And so on the one hand, we have a foundational document as a matter of law, which puts us on the side strongly of life. And we have Supreme Court interpretation, which greatly weakens that. And what Terry Schiavo's case did was to put that in stark relief.
Well, can this be reconciled for those who believe in a culture of life or come under this umbrella of a culture of life? Can you reconcile these two very seemingly conflicting things, this desire to have the government out of your business and yet to uphold what you believe is the sanctity of life?
Well, I think I take from my own ethical and religious tradition that freedom cannot be divorced from the truth of the human person. And so what Terry's case suggests to us as a beginning of reconciliation is that we need to have some serious discussions. Is artificial food and water ordinary care, a basic necessity that cannot be deprived of anyone not facing imminent death by other causes? Or is the very fact that food and water is artificially delivered suggesting that it is not a necessity but an unwarranted interference with the natural process of dying? That discussion has to take place, and it has to be informed by the Catholic tradition, other religious traditions, by medical ethics, by the experience across the globe, because, you know, we're not the only country to face these problems, and the Netherlands and Germany and England and Italy all resolve them quite differently. So one of the things that Terry Schiavo can be for us is a teacher, and it won't be an easy resolution, but one of the things that the congressional enactment did was it imposed a particular view with dubious constitutional authority, and that didn't help anyone. And so the beginning of reconciliation for me would be in two different places. One, I think these discussions appropriately take place at the state level and in state legislatures, and I have some particular ideas for laws that would be useful there. And secondly, I think there are arguments that can be made in both state and federal court that would more strongly affirm life, arguments that can be made under existing generally applicable statutes and don't require the histrionics of a specialized congressional intervention. And I guess I would look to both of those sources to get us underway.
Let me ask you, Wendy Wright, to respond to your question about is providing food and water an intervention that's unnatural. If you're a Christian and you believe that someone has that God's will is moving throughout history and in personal lives, and someone is injured and cannot feed themselves and is in a reduced mental state, is giving them food and water through a feeding tube, is that intervention?
They're not receiving anything more than what you or I need to live. It's just through a different means. Now, in case of Terry, the only reason she had a feeding tube, it was for the convenience of the staff at the hospice, because it takes so long for her to feed her. It took an hour, 2 hours to feed her. I actually have a niece who has less abilities than Terry does. My niece can't follow a balloon with her eyes. My niece can't respond to jokes with laughing. That would be an appropriate response to a mental thing. And we would never think of denying her food and water. So what we're seeing now is the argument that because someone can't speak for themselves, and we have to rely on someone who has a conflict of interest, and just to correct something that Alan said, he claimed that I was mudslinging. In fact, all the information that I gave about Michael is something that came straight from him in depositions, and he's confirmed it in conversations.
You know, I don't want to get into a discussion about the facts of this case,
but
and
what
we're
and looking
what people
at
did.
With
we're,
food
we're talking about the culture of life and
And that does go back to, no, but
facts.
It does matter, because what we have is someone who's speaking on behalf of someone else. And in the case of like Terry or other people who are not able to communicate, we do have to rely on other people. And the presumption should be for life.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's bring in another listener into our conversation. Joe in Reading, Pennsylvania. You're on the air.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Good. First off, real quick to Alan, It's a Catholic belief from Cardinal Bernardin about the steam.
Joe, would you hold on for a moment? We've got to go to a break. I'm sorry.
Sure.
Just hold on. When we come back from a short break, we'll finish up our conversation on the culture of life and get an update on the relief efforts after yesterday's earthquake off the coast of Indonesia. I'm John Itzty. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today, we're talking about the culture of life and how it's changing the wider conservative coalition. Joining the conversation, are conservatism and the culture of life compatible? Call us at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guests are Douglas Kamek, a professor of constitutional law at Pepperdine University, Wendy Wright, a senior policy advisor for Concerned Women of America, Alan Lichtman, professor of political history at American University, and John Green, professor of religion and politics at the University of Akron. And on the phone line right now, waiting patiently, is Joe from Reading, Pennsylvania. Joe, you've got a question for us or a comment?
Yes. Happy Easter, everyone. What I got to say is basically what we're looking at, I think, the reason Congress had to get involved in the first place is because of disfigurement of society by this huge deliberate separation of church and state, so-called. And what I mean by that is not bishops and Catholic clergy or religious clergy telling the government what to do. What I mean by that is society used to have a component, the church, that had very strong influence with the people and government, not influence in the sense of telling the government what to do. But when a moral issue like this came up, the church spoke clearly and politicians paid attention. Now what has happened is the church has been completely and utterly displaced. It's been ghettoized, in my opinion, but it's been said that, you know, you don't speak on these issues, so therefore you're trying to force your religion on other people, and separation of church and state says that you don't have a dog in this fight. So what I'm saying is, who else is going to get involved but Congress?
Joe, interesting question. Let's ask Douglas Kamek to comment on it.
Well, I understand Joe's argument. His argument is that one needs moral leadership in the community, and one has to find it somewhere. Otherwise, there's a vacuum. But we live in a constitutional democracy. It's a constitution of enumerated powers. And unless Congress has a clear basis for its legislative authority, it cannot act, and it didn't have that clear basis here. I do think there is a constitutional question to be answered. The Supreme Court has said that a state may favor life by requiring clear and convincing evidence before a feeding tube is removed. Notice the permissive, that it may favor that life. The real constitutional question that Congress wanted answered, that Terry's parents wanted answered, is where there are willing caregivers, like the Schindlers, must the state, not just may the state, must the state favor life by not allowing disconnection without clear and convincing evidence that the patient's wishes are to the contrary? That was the constitutional question. It never really got litigated in any of the federal courts. And one of the reasons it was is because the poor method by which Congress enacted this statute obscured it, and it could have been raised much more effectively either at the state level or through existing law.
Quick response to that, Wendy Wright, and then to Alan Lichtman.
Well, I can't speak to the legal issues, but I feel very strongly that whatever position you're in, that you have a responsibility to protect innocent life and to do what you can to protect that innocent life. And I definitely respect the rule of law and process, especially having lived in another country where it was not respected. But I think we need to find ways to make sure that the process is ensuring human life.
Alan Lichtman.
Quick comment. I think Professor Kamek raises some very interesting questions that do need to be considered. But once again, some of the contradictions that I've pointed out come into play. It costs money to keep people alive. Where does the money come from in the Terry Schiavo case? Two places. One, a medical liability judgment, and two, Medicaid. And yet conservatives, of course, have been in the forefront of trying to stop big judgments in medical liability cases, limit the power of juries, and, of course, have been in the forefront of trying to cut back Medicaid.
Well, this conversation could go on for a long time, and I sure it will go on for a long time throughout our society. But we want to thank our guests today, Alan Lichtman, a professor of political history at American University, Professor John Green, a professor of religion and politics at the University of Akron, Wendy Wright, senior policy advisor for Concerned Women of America, and Douglas Kamek. He's the chairman and professor of constitutional law at Pepperdine University in Malibu, California. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.